Let me say right off the top that I have prepared for today's show with a mixture of anticipation and trepidation. Anticipation because I believe today's guest, Andrew Bacevich, speaks with a fairly unique mix of experience, authority, passion, and wisdom in questioning our nation's priorities, specifically our willingness to place so much of our national identity, our wealth, our attention, our moral practice, and finally the life and blood of many thousands of our citizens and millions of the citizens of other countries in the hands of our military. He also links this submission to a military view of the world with our corresponding unwillingness and inability to serve each other well here at home. Trepidation, because I fear that we will speak for an hour, wise things will be said, and nothing will change. If the tragedy of Vietnam, the fall of the Soviet Union, the ongoing disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan do not bring change, what can we hope to accomplish in 1 hour? In his previous book, The Limits of Power, Andrew Bacevich pulled things together in ways that I hadn't seen before. Things like our politics of personality, the rise of the imperial presidency, and our national culture of consumption, and how all of those link to our military adventures. In Washington Rules, Bacevich's new book, I'm going to quote him now, he aims to take stock of conventional wisdom in its most influential and enduring form, namely the package of assumptions, habits, and precepts that have defined the tradition of statecraft to which the United States has adhered since the end of World War II, the era of global dominance now drawing to a close. This post-war tradition combines two components, each one so deeply embedded in the American collective consciousness as to have all but disappeared from view. The first component specifies norms according to which the international order ought to work and charges the United States with responsibility for enforcing those norms. Call this, he does, the American credo, to lead, save, liberate, and ultimately transform the world. With regard to means, that tradition has emphasized activism over example, hard power over soft, and coercion, often styled as negotiating from a position of strength over suasion. Above all, the exercise of global leadership as prescribed by the credo obliges the United States to maintain military capabilities staggeringly in excess of those required by self-defense. I highly recommend that people pay attention to Andrew Bacevich. His combination of military experience, commitment to a deep examination of root causes, and his passionate articulation of both questions and answers routinely ignored by far too many make him, I think, a singular voice for sanity, idealism, and a wholly reconsidered view of American society and our role in the world. Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, served 23 years in the U.S. Army, retiring with the rank of colonel. He also lost his son in Iraq. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he received his Ph.D. in American diplomatic history from Princeton University. His writing has appeared in Foreign Affairs, The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times, The L.A. Times, The Wall Street Journal. He's the author of several books, including The New American Militarism, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, and his newest, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Welcome again, Andrew Bacevich.
Oh, thanks very much, and thanks especially for that very generous introduction.
Well, you're very welcome. I always like to start the show with getting listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we will talk about. Now, your book, Washington Rules, opens with a moment in your life that you offer there as a turning point. Could you share that experience?
Sure. The moment occurred shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I was still in the Army at the time. With my family, I had spent a considerable time serving in Germany, but we'd never been to Berlin. And so not long after unification, we went to that city for a visit, and it was in the wintertime. I, in particular, wanted to visit the Brandenburg Gate because, for me, as I think for many other people, the Brandenburg Gate really had been for decades this quintessential symbol of international politics in our time. And so late in the evening, rainy night, very cold, we approached the Brandenburg Gate from the old East Berlin side, and what I found there came as a great surprise to me. What we found was young men huddled between the columns of the gate, peddling souvenirs. And the souvenirs were bits and pieces of Soviet military accoutrements, buttons, hats, parts of uniforms. I bought a wristwatch emblazoned with the symbol of the Soviet tank corps, which broke about 2 weeks later. And it was all junk. And the men, who clearly were off-duty Russian soldiers, looked anything but 10 feet tall. And it was at that moment, I'm not going to say my worldview suddenly was transformed, but it was at that moment that certain seeds of doubt were planted, and I began to wonder if I had misperceived the other that I was now confronting for the first time. And as I considered that possibility, I also subsequently began to entertain the possibility that I had misperceived many other things. And that, I think, began an intellectual journey that has continued now for about 20 years.
Okay, thank you. That's the voice of Andrew Bacevich. We're speaking about some of the ideas in his new book, Washington Rules. So it appears from that, as you say, that wasn't, you know, the absolute epiphany kind of an experience, but it began a process. And it seems to me you set forth on a process then of inquiry and self-education to learn what had been obscured to you in the past. Is that true? And while you were still in the military, you began this process?
Well, it wasn't too much. It was maybe 2 years after that that I left the Army. And I think that's when the questions began to become fast and furious. And what I came to realize, and it's not some startling insight, is that when you exist inside of an institution, particularly an institution that in a sense has an all-encompassing role, whether you're the member of a religious order, for example, but it's true, I think, for members of the military profession, it's very difficult to view that institution critically. It's very difficult even to understand some of the assumptions that define the institution's view of truth. It's only when you get away, when you are able to stand apart from the institution, that critical thought becomes possible. So it was really when I left the Army in 1992, I think, that the process of seeking to identify and to answer first-order questions really began.
And what do you mean by first-order questions? I think that's very much, in some sense, the added element to this book.
Well, I think, I mean, a couple of the first-order questions that have, to my mind, they're first-order questions. Others may see it differently, that have preoccupied me. One of them would be, what exactly is it that drives U.S. policy? What is it that makes us do what we do with regard to the rest of the world? And as a young boy growing up and as a serving officer, I generally accepted the official view, which was that we did what we did because it was necessary for us to respond to external threats, that our policy, in a sense, was defensive and reactive. And I subsequently came to believe that that's not true, that we do what we do largely in response to domestic political and economic and ideological imperatives, that the motive force for U.S. policy emerges from within. It does not come from without. I think a second first-order question had to do with the nature of war and the efficacy of force. And I think most military professionals accept the conviction within their profession that war continues to be an effective instrument of statecraft. And despite my own service in Vietnam, which I recognize certainly what had been a disaster, I still largely subscribed to that idea. It was only after I got out of Vietnam, and in particular, after I got out of the Army, and in particular after U.S. policy in the Cold War embarked upon what seemed to be a never-ending series of interventions abroad, most of which failed to deliver on the promises that had justified them, I really began to rethink my view of war itself.
Very good. When it makes sense, I like to build the interview around a format that I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It. And it focuses on three big questions about the issue on the table, in this case, American foreign and military policy and action. And the three questions are, how is it broken? What is the evidence? How did it get broken? What are the causes, the history, the culprits? And finally, of course, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? Can we kind of take that umbrella approach? Obviously, we will ask other questions. We will go down other pathways. But does that work for you?
Sure, I think so.
Okay. So first, how is it broken? What is the crucial evidence to you that America's approach is broken, doesn't work, etc.?
Well, I mean, I think that an effective approach to national security will be one that will keep us safe, will preserve and even enhance our prosperity, thereby enabling us as citizens to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And it will do all that at a relatively reasonable cost. And I think it's pretty clear, especially if we look at the post-9/11 period, that the existing approach to national security policy, what I call the Washington Rules, fails on every point. It's not keeping us safe. It's certainly depleting our resources. It's not building our prosperity. And it's costing a ton of money. The Washington Rules that I try to describe in the book originated in the immediate wake of World War II, were expressions of a national security consensus that may well have worked at one time. But I think I would argue strongly that they no longer work at all. And for that reason, this consensus, having outlived its utility, is badly in need of being junked.
Okay, and just so people can kind of get your context, at this point, tell what those rules are. It consists, as I mentioned it in the introduction, of a credo and then a trinity of means, right?
Right. I mean, the credo, in a sense, asserts a claim. And out of that claim comes a demand that the United States be able to exercise certain prerogatives. But the second piece of the Washington Rules is what I label the Sacred Trinity. And the Sacred Trinity really are those core principles that define the way we conceive of and use our military power. And the elements of the Sacred Trinity are the following. First of all, a demand that the United States and the United States exclusively should maintain a global military presence. The practice of configuring U.S. forces not to defend the country, that really figures as an afterthought, but to configure U.S. forces so that they can serve as instruments of power projection. And then finally, the third element of the Trinity, to combine that global presence with those global power projection capabilities to support a policy of global interventionism. I mean, this Sacred Trinity is really what distinguishes the United States U.S. military power. You know, the Brits at one time had a dominant battle fleet. France in the time of Napoleon had a people in arms. Well, what we have is this Sacred Trinity. And again, to emphasize what I think is the key point, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And we will get into later kind of why it survives its numerous failures, which I think is one of the real core things that you look at both in your 20-year examination and in this book. One of the points you make, though, is that it consistently goes unquestioned, and that when you mentioned before first order questions, everyone, it seems, both parties and certainly the mainstream media, begins at second and third order questions, right?
Exactly right. I mean, one of the reasons that I use kind of religiously loaded language to describe the Washington rules when I talk kind of an American credo and a sacred trinity is that I think that this approach to national security policy really has ascended to the point that it's kind of a quasi-religion. Washington subscribes to these principles really as a matter of faith. There's no empirical evidence to suggest that the American credo is valid, is true. But every president, up to and including President Obama, in their speeches, in their language, repeatedly, in somewhat different words from one president to the next, but repeatedly reaffirms the credo, and the policies pursued by the Pentagon, supported by the Congress, largely endorsed by the mainstream media, reaffirm the elements of the Sacred Trinity as well.
Yeah, let me just, if I may, read just a piece of Obama's speech last December when after the very public period of decision-making announced the United States would send an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan. More than any other nation, the United States of America has underwritten global security for over six decades, a time that for all its problems has seen walls come down, markets open, billions lifted from poverty, unparalleled scientific progress, advancing frontiers of human liberty. For unlike the great powers of old, we have not sought world domination. Our union was founded in resistance to oppression. We do not seek to occupy other nations. We will not claim another nation's resources or target other people because their faith or ethnicity is different from ours. What we have fought for, what we continue to fight for, is a better future for our children and grandchildren, and we believe that their lives will be better if other people's children and grandchildren can live in freedom and access opportunity. That very much, it seems to me, has that sense, whether he and his speechwriters are aware of it or not, of what you're speaking about is a credo handed down and untouchable and unquestionable.
And it is such a sanitized version of our history in the past five or six decades that it almost, I mean, it shouldn't pass the laugh test. And yet that is, I think, an excellent example of the way political leaders perpetuate the credo. You know, it was Obama putting his own stamp of approval on an image of our role in the world that everybody, at least since Franklin Roosevelt, has embraced.
Yeah, in other words, using again that religious metaphor, someone ascends to the cardinalship of some place or whatever, and they then go before the public and show, this is me now pledging my allegiance to the credo that's been handed down to me.
Exactly.
How did it get broken? What are the causes, the history, and the culprits? And let me say to people that in this book, although you certainly deal with the present predicament, you deal with Iraq and Afghanistan, you also take us back to, there are characters in there I hadn't read about in a while, like Alan Dulles and Curtis LeMay and Maxwell Taylor. So a bit, your short version of how we got here from, let's say, the end of World War II.
Yeah, I think the short version goes like this. When the national security consensus was forged in the wake of World War II, when the Washington rules came into existence, they were not entirely irrational. Matter of fact, I think you can make a strong case that American leadership and American military power were necessary, necessary in order to try to deal with the wreckage left behind by World War II, to help to rebuild the liberal democratic world, to be in a position to resist the ambitions of Joseph Stalin. The problem is that that world that existed at the end of the 1940s no longer exists today. And yet people in Washington tend to act as if the world has not changed at all. So where did things go wrong? Things went wrong when the institutional commitment to the Washington rules, the value placed in the Washington rule by institutions, and institutions I mean the Pentagon, the CIA, the components of the military-industrial complex, when they came to value the Washington rules because they were good for the institutions, and they gradually lost sight of the extent to which adhering to this national security consensus was good or not good for the nation itself. Let's get to some specifics here. Let's talk about this idea of a global military presence. In the wake of World War II, that presence first took shape in the creation of an American presence, for example, in Western Europe and also in Japan. Probably it was necessary, I think, in the near term, that presence abroad contributed to our safety and our well-being. But if we fast forward to the post-Cold War period, in particular, the increasing military presence in places like the greater Middle East, you'd have to be crazy to think that the American military presence in Saudi Arabia after the first Gulf War, or in Iraq after 2003, or in Afghanistan ever since 9/11, you'd have to be crazy to think that that's contributing to stability and security. What that presence abroad is doing is actually enhancing anti-Americanism and creating greater instability. But the Pentagon, committed to the proposition that we need to maintain this global military presence, is blind to the downside of these habits.
Right. Okay. That is the short version. Let me. I want to get in a few minutes, really, into the current Afghanistan situation. But let me ask you, because some of this research that is not in today's news is not, you know, maybe, as I said, I hadn't seen in a while, that there has been a flexibility about interpretation. For as one example, perhaps. Just how Kennedy comes in and reverses Eisenhower's stance and ends up going to Vietnam. Petraeus, as another example, at one point seems to be absolutely against anything that would ever be counterinsurgency and later becomes the god of counterinsurgency. Could you talk to us a little bit about how it's sort of there's a flexibility and adaptability, not, again, at first-order questions or why are we doing this, but in how to pull it off.
Well, periodically, in this roughly six-decade-long period that the book tries to evaluate, periodically there arises a great desire to create new instruments of military power that will make that power more usable. And you cited two very good examples of this tendency. By the time we get to the end of the 1950s, the end of the Eisenhower era, Ike and those around him had pretty much concluded that war as traditionally conceived of had reached a dead end. That nuclear weapons, for the most part, made force unusable. Hence Eisenhower's policy of massive retaliation that just sort of, you know, waved the big stick and tried to keep the Soviets from doing anything. The people that came into office with Kennedy thought that that was inadequate. They wanted to make force usable, and they pursued this idea under the rubric of flexible response, which ended up really being one of the defective ideas that put us on the road to Vietnam. Fast forward to the Iraq War and the aftermath of the 2003 invasion, when the United States thinking that it achieved a great victory, suddenly found itself faced with an insurgency that it and the prospect of never-ending conflict there. And now we have David Petraeus leading the way, but not he alone, in trying to revive an approach to warfare that once again would make American military power useful, which he then applied in the surge and that Obama then subsequently applied in his Afghan surge. So there is this tendency, this reoccurring tendency to want to be able to find ways to make force work.
The Founding Fathers are constantly referred to by the right, even more than the left, as the source of direction and wisdom and so on. Yet, as you point out, their counsel on foreign policy is absolutely the opposite of where we are now and where we've been for these past 50 years. It is not only not followed, it's totally ignored. And if you, I'm going to read a quote of yours, and then I want you to speak about that. You write, "We are headed towards, I think, ever greater, more difficult economic times that will result in us failing in our most fundamental obligation laid out in the preamble of the Constitution, which is to provide the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. The path on which we have embarked and on which we continue to pursue is very much at odds with what the founding purpose of this republic was supposed to be."
Well, I think in that quote from the preamble, to my mind, the most important word is posterity. I mean that the purpose of the Union that was forged is not simply to act in ways that will make you and me happy, but we are called upon to pursue a path that will also enable those who follow us to have an opportunity to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And, of course, everybody sort of mouths that cliché, but it's becoming increasingly apparent, I think, above all, in this enormous debt that we are piling up, not entirely due to our misguided national security policy, but in part due to our misguided national security policy. I think that we are increasingly approaching the point where it's going to become impossible for posterity to have the same opportunities that we have. And that, therefore, is in itself one enormously important reason to take stock of where we are headed in our over-militarized approach to policy.
Okay. So, as you say, and let me remind people, when a president, who now love to call themselves commander-in-chief, takes the oath of office, it is not to defend our shores or to defend even our geography, it even our populace. It is to defend our Constitution. And
well,
and that seems to I'm trying to get there is that these founding principles, which are the reason that, I mean, as you point out, some of the, if you read Adams, Washington, and so on, they said our role is as an exemplar, not as an enforcer.
And I think that it's time to renew that argument. I mean, to the extent that we have a responsibility to the world, I mean, should we try to fulfill that responsibility as we, in taking the approach to leadership that we've pursued for the past 60 years, which we must acknowledge is increasingly based on expectations of what military power can do? Or is it not at least possible that we can provide that positive effect for others by demonstrating that liberal values do have value? That fulfilling the aspirations expressed in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution could serve at least modestly to help other peoples and other nations to find their own to take their own path for their own self-determination, rather than thinking, as we do in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, that we know best how to determine their future. I mean, I find it preposterous that even President Obama, someone who I think is a tremendously smart man and someone who basically I respect, preposterous to think that we have the ability to create a state, create a government, create institutions across this enormous, vast cultural divide that separates Afghans from Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Since we've just ventured into the discussion of Afghanistan, let me set this up this way. On 9/11, I remember I went out that afternoon, kind of shell-shocked, as we all were, and I remember I walked along the beach, and I asked myself, what's the question we should be asking now? And to me it was, have we done everything we could to minimize the possibilities of such terrorism? And of course, security would be part of the answer, but much more so, it would be whatever we could do to isolate such terrorists as pariahs in their own society, which would be so many more things about being an exemplar, about perhaps even things like Marshall Plans, perhaps finding a way to do education that doesn't trample on culture, etc., etc. Now we look, July was the deadliest month for the U.S. military in Afghanistan, 66 deaths, a devastating month for Afghans, more than 270 civilians killed, 600 wounded. And rather than ask you, what do you think needs to happen in Afghanistan right now, let me ask a larger question, which is really your question. What exactly is the threat that the United States faces from these radical, violent Islamists, and what strategy should the United States pursue in order to deal with that threat?
Well, that's an excellent question. First of all, the threat is not Islamo-fascism. The threat is not Nazi Germany in some sort of a new guise. Those sort of notions that were frequently voiced after 9/11 and are still voiced, I think, in sort of the more militarized quarters of the right wing, those are ludicrous. The violent anti-Western jihadism does pose a real threat, but the threat falls well short of being existential. The notion that somebody like Osama bin Laden, who has ambitions to create a new caliphate, uniting the entire Islamic world under his control, the notion that we should take his ambition seriously is preposterous. He's no more likely to create a new caliphate than I am to become the next pope in Rome. The threat, it seems to me, ought to have been categorized, and today should be categorized, as a form of international criminal conspiracy, a kind of a mafia that derives a certain amount of its energy by perverting a religious tradition. And the proper response to an international criminal conspiracy is an international police effort. Our approach, President Bush's approach, now continued in Afghanistan by President Obama, which emphasizes invading, occupying, and then trying to transform countries, that approach doesn't work, costs way too much money, expends far too many American lives, and at the end of the day probably serves more than anything else to simply exacerbate the number of people who see us as infidels and occupiers.
Right. So on the response side, you say treat it as a criminal conspiracy, and we won't go into it, but the example of the countries who have done so, or even the instances where we have done so, we have found some success, certainly in contrast to these massive war approaches. What about in terms of prevention? In other words, going back to that question,
Here I suspect I may differ from you. I mean, when you were mentioning things like a Marshall Plan or programs like that, I'm pretty skeptical about our ability to mobilize resources in ways that can engineer positive change in the Islamic world. My belief would be that the people of the Islamic world are going to have to find their own path to reconciling their religious tradition with the demands of modernity. Now, I don't mean that we should, you know, turn our backs on this dilemma that they are wrestling with. Yes, let's have exchange programs. Let's bring young people from that part of the world to study in our universities. Let's encourage cultural exchanges. But I really don't believe that in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in Pakistan or in Yemen or you name it, that somehow or other a set of programs put together by the federal government of the United States can make anything more than a marginal difference. My own view is that we need to let Islam be Islam. They are going to have to sort out their own future. What we need to do is, in the interim, is to insulate ourselves from any violence that the internal crisis in the Islamic world may give rise to. To my mind, you know, the most important thing to take from 9/11 is that our federal, state, and local agencies charged with defending us failed.
Yes.
We were like, you know, if you leave the front door of your house wide open every night, and sooner or later somebody comes in and steals the family silver, well, yes, certainly the crooks need to be pursued and brought to justice, but shame on you for letting your front door open. And in effect, that was what the agencies responsible for aviation security had done up until 9/11.
Okay, yeah, and I realize now that some of my thoughts on 9/11, as I was remembering them, would have shifted by now. For one, the America that could afford a Marshall Plan after World War II is not the one that we exist in right now.
I think that's tremendously important. You know, again, we don't live in the world that existed in 1947, when the Marshall Plan was enacted. In 1947, we had the money, and we made the stuff that everybody else wanted to buy around the world. We now live in a world in which increasingly the Chinese have the money, and everybody makes stuff that our never-ending appetite for consumption insists that we need to buy, despite the fact that it just makes us go deeper in debt.
Yeah, and that area about our hunger for consumption and our ignorance of meaning, you go into much more in your previous book, Limits of Power, which I highly recommend. As you point out, Petraeus was someone who at one point was reflecting on Vietnam, thought counterinsurgency had no future. Then he writes a reformulation of counterinsurgency, and that becomes the solution. Two things about that. One is that what seems to have gone unnoticed, or at least not spoken about that much, is that really this whole surge, counterinsurgency, all of that, is based on a recognition that victory is impossible.
Yes. You know, I spoke earlier about this periodic effort to reinvent war and try to make it more effective. That occurred in the wake of Vietnam, where the real drivers of military reform were soldiers. I mean, the army in particular wanted to run away from counterinsurgency as fast as it possibly could and return to the business of conventional war. Experiences in Desert Storm in 1991 and in Iraq in 2003, in the second Iraq War, for a time seemingly showed that the U.S. military had figured out how to gain a quick and decisive victory. I mean, that was an illusion.
Yep.
It was an illusion that the insurgency in Iraq and now the insurgency in Afghanistan has dispatched. The counterinsurgency doctrine revived by Petraeus, oddly, I think from the point of view of the officer corps, in effect declares that there is no such thing as a military solution to conflicts like these, And certainly there is no such thing as military victory. I say that's odd. It may not be an odd notion to many of your listeners, but the whole notion that victory is possible really forms the basis of the military profession's claim to have a distinct professional existence.
And value.
Exactly, because if we can't count on the Army to win the war quickly and expeditiously, then why would we ever go to war in the first place?
Right. Then those other tools of soft power and other forms of engagement, suddenly you have to say, well, wait a minute. Those are where we have to look, because this one has enormous cost, and if it can't ensure success, you know, et cetera.
Even for a skeptic of soft power like me, if you would say, well, we've spent probably close to $1 trillion in Iraq on the war, look what we've gotten. Had we spent $1 trillion elsewhere in the Islamic world promoting education programs or economic development or women's rights, would we have gotten more for our $1 trillion invested in soft power than we got for our $1 trillion invested in the Iraq war? Even a skeptic of soft power like me would say, I have no doubt that we would have gotten more.
Right. Nick Kristof had an article just recently, I assume you saw it, that said one soldier equals 20 schools, in which he said that at this cost now of $1 million per soldier in Afghanistan, everyone we who is not there, if we wanted to spend that same money, we could start 20 schools in Afghanistan. I want you to respond to this statement by President Obama, based on what we just said, which is that counterinsurgency recognizes the unlikelihood or inability of victory. President Obama, the United States of America does not quit once it starts on something. You don't quit. The American Armed Services does not quit. We keep at it. We persevere, and together with our partners, we will prevail. I am absolutely confident of that. What is he saying?
Well...
Didn't he know that would be on YouTube?
I don't know why he says things like that, and let me explain why. My assumption is that politicians always place political considerations at the heart of what they say and what they do, or at least they are surrounded by advisors who are acutely sensitive to the politics of whatever happens to be going on. And so we have a president who, in his decision to surge last December 2009, embraced counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, and then proceeded really preposterously to establish a deadline of the summer of 2011 to begin withdrawing U.S. forces. The likelihood of being able to successfully prosecute a counterinsurgency over a period of 18 months just is not very great. So the president, I think, come the summer of 2011, when political considerations will really be moving to center stage.
If I may cut in, it won't be Congress he's worried about, it's his own presidency.
Exactly right. And how the heck he is going to deal with these we never quit, I know we will prevail promises, if the war is still going badly at that point, I think the president's going to be in a real fix.
Right. And let me then go to this July article that you wrote called Non-Believer, in which you contrast George Bush and Barack Obama. And you quote, I'm going to quote you, when Bush stands before his maker, he will say without fear of contradiction, I did what I thought was right. On the other hand, when called upon to account for his presidency, honesty will prevent Obama from making comparable claim. The problems I inherited were difficult ones, he will say. None of the choices were good ones. Things were complicated. And your final paragraph of that piece, the question demands to be asked, who is more deserving of contempt, the commander-in-chief who sends young Americans to die for a cause, however misguided, in which he sincerely believes, or the commander-in-chief who sends young Americans to die for a cause in which he manifestly does not believe and yet refuses to forsake?
Well, I think the president, with the Afghanistan decision, was trying to sort of finesse a set of problems. I mean, at that point, I think he wanted to spend his chips on certain domestic reform propositions, health care and economic stimulus. And my guess is that he or those around him persuaded him that to take on the Washington rules at that particular moment would have been very difficult, and indeed it would have been very difficult. So my guess is that, and it's only a guess, is that he decided that the more expedient course was to continue to play along with the Washington rules in Afghanistan, to make good on his domestic reform plans, and then go back to the war. My fear is, my belief is, that it's going to be too late, that Obama's war, having become Obama's war, is not going to be something that he's going to be able to easily back away from in 2011. And yet, if he persists in fighting Obama's war, then many of us who supported him for the presidency in the first place are going to wonder if maybe our vote should go elsewhere.
Yeah. And at this point, let's turn to the deeper question. We can't expect you to read Obama's mind, his advisor's mind, or anyone who's been in power for the last 50 years. But what is it that makes the Washington rules, this credo that they all sign on to, what is it that keeps it going in the face of, as I pointed out, Vietnam, the fall of the Soviet Union, Iraq, Afghanistan, and all of the other adventures? Let me just make one aside. Under Reagan, Bush Sr., and Clinton, you put out, use of force became more frequent and less controversial. It wasn't that the end of the Cold War made us stop this stuff. We did it, and then it got worse under Bush, but it didn't. Bush wasn't, the beginning of this problem. Who are they beholden to? What is their calculus? What is their analysis that keeps them doing this when it seems to have so much downside?
Well, the downside is for the country. The downside is not for Washington. I mean, the Washington rules benefit Washington. The Washington rules provide enormous profits for the military-industrial complex. Out of those profits come campaign contributions to members of Congress who are, of course, always worried about securing re-election. The Washington rules justify the budget of the Pentagon and of the intelligence community. They provide a source of prerogatives for institutions and for people. They allow ambitious military officers and senior officials to believe that they are engaged in important and historic events. They allow the media. They create the rush that I think so many journalists seek. Nobody gets more excited about going to war than the press.
Ain't it the truth? They love that picture of them in a war zone.
So the Washington rules persist partly because we the people are conditioned to think that there are no alternatives, and therefore we the people have lost our ability to think critically. But I think more importantly, the Washington rules persist because they do deliver a variety of goods to Washington itself.
Finally, final question, maybe 2 minutes. If you could look back from, say, a decade in the future, from 2020, did the U.S. turn things around in this regard? And if your answer is no, what were some of the consequences? If your answer is yes, how did we do it?
Oh, from the perspective of 2020?
Yeah.
My guess is that we will not have turned it around. And the only way that we will turn it around is if the American people become truly cognizant of the negative effects of persisting in the Washington rules. The fact that we rely on a all-volunteer army, of course, means that most of us don't really share in the service and sacrifice of perpetual war. The fact that the wars are funded through deficit spending means that we don't even feel these wars in our pocketbook. If there is some further economic calamity, if there is some, and I obviously don't want this to happen, some further 9/11 style calamity, perhaps that would jolt Americans into a recognition that something's fundamentally amiss and something needs to change. My guess is, however, that is not all that likely.
Thank you very much. So my anticipation and my trepidation, both accurate. So again, the book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Thank you, Andrew Bacevich, and keep up the good work.
Thanks very much.